Okay, we're starting Perek Shishi, HaMocher Peirot. I just wanted to point out, we had HaMocher Et HaBayit, HaMocher Et HaSpina, HaMocher Peirot, right? It's very organized, the Mishnayot. Okay, so now we're getting to cases of Rov. Today is going to be, we've seen these over and over again. They come up in all sorts of contexts about the Dinim of Rov and how the Rov is Kovea, right? And how, when do we go by Rov? When don't we hold by Rov? We're going to talk about this more today. HaMocher Peirot L'Chaveiro. He sells fruits to his friend. Now, generally, what do people sell fruits for? To eat, right? However, some people sell fruits in order to plant the seeds, to grow new fruits. So, according to the Rashbam, you can see, he sells the Peirot Stam, Velo Peresh Im Lizria Im La'achila. Okay, he didn't explain whether he was buying them for the, in order to replant them, or he was buying them to eat. And the guy actually wanted to plant them, although again, he didn't say so at the time he was making the sale, and you have to assume, right, most people buy fruits to eat, not to plant. So he plants them and they don't grow. Vafilu zera pishtan, and even zera pishtan, right, we all know people eat flax seeds now, but flax seeds is not the most common thing to eat. And generally, if you are buying flax seeds, you're probably buying it to plant, certainly in those days. The person who sold it is, So it's as if, in this case, we're going to say, the mocher, I got confused for a second because it says, dehavi mekach ta'ut. Because that's the other case. That's why I got confused. Eino chayav bachor yutan means he's not responsible. The owner, the seller, right? Since the buyer didn't specify what it is he wanted, therefore, you can say, I thought it was just fine by selling the flax seeds. You could eat them. You know, they were good for eating. You could have eaten them. And not my problem. Rameshim ben Gamliel omer, zeronei gina she'enan echalim chayav bachor yutan. He adds that, by the way, if you're talking about seeds for planting a garden, which are not edible, clearly, right, if you would go now to plant, right, you wouldn't generally take a fruit, buy a fruit, and then plant the seeds in the ground, even though some people do that. You can see my husband decided to plant an avocado. He's got a little avocado pit growing there. But anyway, generally, people don't buy avocados in order to replant them and plant a tree. But if they do buy seeds, then clearly you're responsible if the seeds, right, if the seeds end up being a wash, right, it's happened to me before, I planted seeds and nothing happens. I didn't think, oh, let me go back to the store owner and get my money back because whatever, but I figured maybe it was my fault. But according to this, the seeds were duds, basically, and you can go back and say this is a mekach ta'ut. Okay? Itmar. The Gemara now says.
Can I just interrupt a second? The thing that I find strange about it, it's not like a piece of furniture where maybe you know that it wasn't made correctly. Even the seller, he can't really know if the seeds are going to be good.
Right.
Well, it seems very extreme. It's a level.
Yeah. I think if you're buying a couple of seeds, or you're one person buying seeds, but if you're a farmer, you're planting your field, and things don't come up in the field, you can't blame the seed seller because you wouldn't have expected that you would get a pretty good yield. You know, like one person or whatever.
Seems there's so many variables that you can't tell who's to blame.
Right.
There are so many reasons something won't grow. It could be somebody, it could be any, you know, it certainly could be the sellers,
yeah,
but it could also be the weather. I mean,
it could be, but there are certain ways of, there's certain
I assume also there are certain seeds that are better than other seeds, and
see,
maybe the person who sells seeds is supposed to know this type of information.
Well, everybody discovers that their seeds don't grow.
I
mean, somehow nobody's seeds grow, then it's more
it's like that story, the empty pot.
Yeah.
You know that story? It's a great, right, where they give these duds to all the kids and they say, grow, you know, whoever, they're looking for a new emperor and they say, whoever grows these seeds will become the emperor. You know, whoever grows it the nicest. And everybody plants the seeds and nothing happens. And then everybody basically finds other seeds, plants them, and comes to the emperor with their beautiful pot of flowers. And only one kid walks up and says, this is what happened. You know, nothing grew. He said, you're the emperor. You know, that's the... Right, so I think that there's a concept that there's seeds that are, you know, you can imagine sellers are always trying to kind of sell things that are not, that are substandard, and that's what I think is going on here. Okay, But what the real question is really going to be from the first case in the Mishnah, which is, if you don't specify for what you're selling something, how do we determine what really your intent was? So let's say we're going to get into cases we've seen before. The next case is going to be, we'll see right now, Itmar, there's a machloket emoraim, about hamocher shor lechavero v'nimtza nagchan. You sell a shor to your friend, and it turns out he's a crazy, wild shor that starts goring everybody. Obviously, you're going to incur costs. But all the more so, the only thing you can do with this shor is kill it. Now, what's the purpose of killing it? Right, to eat it. So there's two reasons why people sell an ox. One is for eating, and one is for plowing. Now, obviously, the plowing one is going to cost more money than the eating one, because to eat, you're going to sheft it once, have the meat, and be done with it. If you're selling it to plow, you're selling it for more money, because the person's going to have a lot of use out of it. So now, it turns out, this person now can no longer use this shor for harisha, for plowing. But who's to say that he bought it with the intent to use it for plowing? We don't really know. So Rav Amar, now obviously I added this extra thing, which that there's a price difference, so we're going to talk about that. So don't worry. Maybe shouldn't have mentioned it yet, because then we could have assumed really we're talking about an equal suffix, because that's in the end the Gemara is going to have to say. It must be a case where the financial amounts are equal, and we'll see why in a minute. So Rav Amar, hareze mekach ta'ut. This is a classic mekach ta'ut. You bought a shor. We're assuming you bought it to plow. And this shor can't be used for plowing. He's a nagchan. And therefore, right, you can't... okay, so actually, I thought this was interesting. The Rashbam says here, mekach ta'ut. He compares it, ki yayim v'nimtza chometz. He says it's just like wine, which turned out to be vinegar. So I wondered about this comparison, because wine and vinegar are really two different... We talked about this before. The wine and vinegar are two totally different things. Now, it's true.
They evolve.
Okay, and that's, I guess, where the Rashbam is coming from. And he's saying, this shor maybe was at some point right with Lacharisha, but he evolved and he's no longer. By the way, the Rashbam adds, Nimtza shayana khan kodem mechira. Right, you have to prove that it wasn't, you know, maybe he got to his new owner, didn't like his new owner, and became crazy. Right, you'd have to prove somehow that, or, you know, that there had to be some sort of proof that
the seller might have known.
Right, that the seller would have known. I wondered if it's really like Yayin v'nimtza chometz, because those are really two totally different things, whereas a shor is a shor. It's a shor, whether it's a shor for harisha or a shor for eating, it's still called a shor. It even has the same name, right? When we talked about yayin and chometz, we said they're even two totally different names, right? Now, it's true, one evolves from the other, but it's like a butterfly and a caterpillar. They're two totally different things. One evolves from the other. But here, I don't know if you could say that a shor nagchan and a shor l'harisha, it evolves, maybe. I think it's debatable whether it's the same thing or not. So Rav Amar Hareza Mekach Ta'ut, and you can get your money back, and you know, give the shor back, get your money back. Ushmuel Amar Yachol Amar Lo Lishchita Mechartiv Lecha. Right, you could say, the seller can say, hey, I sold it for you for shechting purposes, and therefore, you're stuck with it. Now, why does Shmuel say this? Right, Rav seems pretty reasonable. You bought your shor for Harisha, it wasn't for Harisha. But what does Shmuel say? Hamotzi Mechavero Alav Haraya, basically. The shor is in your hands. Now prove to me that it was clear from the outset that you bought it for harisha. You might just be claiming that right now, but who's to know that that's really why you bought it? And therefore, unless you can prove that it was clear, that there was evidence that you bought it for harisha, therefore, you can't get your money back. Okay. So now we're going to get more into the issues of Rav and Shmuel. This was just the basics. We're going to see inside exactly what the root of the machloket is, but soon, not yet. So now the Gemara questions. It says, "V'lechzi igavra dezeben lenichsita iliradia liradia." If he's a guy who generally, right? In other words, is this a butcher where he's selling meat for people to eat? Now, obviously, he's selling the animal live here, but is it a guy who generally sells for meat, or is it a guy who generally sells for harisha? And it's the buyer. My mistake. Is it, right, I got confused because Zabin is used in both ways. Is it that the person generally buys oxen for working them? Or is he generally the guy who goes to buy meat all the time? Is he a big meat eater? You know, why don't you go see his track record? So what do they say? Obviously, we're talking about a case. It's obviously a guy who sometimes buys for harishan, sometimes buys for eating, and therefore for shchita, and therefore there's no real way to know. And that's why we have this suffix. Okay, so by the way, we're narrowing the case. As we go along, we're going to keep on narrowing it and narrowing it, okay? First, we're saying it's only where the buyer is unknown where he goes in general. Then they say, like we said before, why don't we see what he paid? And based on the price, remember we had this whole thing before, whether damim can be mochiach or not, let's see how much he paid for. So what do they say? Lotzricha de'iyakir bisra v'kam v'demei radya. So again, we're narrowing the case because we're saying it's only in a case where all of a sudden the price of meat for eating purposes jumped up and it was now equal to the price of animals for harisha. So now we're saying basically, so again, we're narrowing the case because if it were a case where, so number one, if it were a case where it's obvious this guy only buys shvarim for harisha or only buys them for eating, then we knew. And if it's a case where the money can prove which way it goes, then also it's obvious. So the case here is where there's a doubt. So then they say, Ihachi lamai nafkamina. Well, then what's the relevance? If you bought a shor, and it's now, let's say even you bought it for 60, and it now jumped up to 100, and 100 is the price for harisha, and you want it, no, let me just think, wait, which case is it? You bought it for 100... Right, and then all the prices became equal. And as you want to say, well, now the price went down because it's only good for shechita, and I bought it for 100, but now the price for shechita went up. So now what's the difference? You now have a shor that's worth 100 shekels. It doesn't make a difference, right? You could just sell it, right? And then you don't have to go back to the original owner and say, hey, give me my money back because I wanted something that's worth 100 and you gave me something worth 60 because now what you have in your hand is worth 100 too. So just sell it to somebody.
Except if he's a nakhan.
No, but you can sell a shor l'nakhan to a shochet, he'll shecht it right then. You get the sense that people aren't scared of shor l'nakhan, that they're not willing to shecht them. The point is a shor l'nakhan is fine if you just shecht him. So, right, okay, right, very pleasant, but anyway. So at that point, what's the nafkamina? You don't need to, sit, whether it's a mechach ta'ud or you keep it, it's all the same. You have the same amount of money either which way. You have an animal that's worth 100. What's the difference? So what do they say? Nafkamina letircha. But what's the problem? If you want to get your 100 shekel back, right, if you just go to the seller and say, give me my money back, so you should give you your money back. But if you have to sell it to get your money back, that's a headache. Maybe like Ruth said, who's going to want to buy a shor nakhan? Right? Maybe you won't find anyone to sell it. Either which way, it's effort for you to have to sell. And that's the nafkamina about whether we say, Rav will say, Harei Zemekach Ta'ud, he can go straight to the guy and get his money back. And Shmuel says, no, you're going to have to suffer and go and, you know, since you don't have a way to prove what you bought it for, you're the one who's going to have to make the effort. Now they're going to question Rav a little bit. Rav said, there's a few different explanations about how to read this question, but we're going to go with this. Rav says, Hareza mekach ta'ud. So the Gemara says, Hechidami, I deleka lishtalume mine, li'akev Torah bezuze, damri inshe, mimari reshutech, pari ephra. So now they're questioning Rav, and they're saying, what's the case? Because if he doesn't have money to pay back, okay, in other words, there's this concept that we've learned this before, that depending on what you're owed the money for, there's different categories of whether you have to pay in cash or you can pay through metaltalin. So they're basically saying, according to Rav, you say it's a mekach ta'ut, but since the owner, if the owner doesn't have money, let's say, I bought this shor, I gave the guy money, the seller, he spent the money already, and he doesn't have money to give me money back, right? So what would I do in that case? Li'akev Torah bezuzeh. I would keep the shor in place of the zuzim, right? Basically, to mekach ta'ud, he's supposed to get his shor back. But since she doesn't have the money to give me back, I just keep the shor and I have the money. How do we know this? Damar inche, because people say, min mari reshutech pari ephra. From the person who you owe money to, you can even give bran, which is not considered the highest quality of items. You can even give bran of the value of what you owe. And therefore, in this case, really, Rav, they say to him, if the guy doesn't have money to pay for it, then basically there's no difference. Because to say mekach ta'ut means the exact same thing as Shmuel. Because what did Shmuel say? Tough luck, you're stuck with it, go sell it. It's exactly what we're saying now. If the guy doesn't have cash, so what would Rav end up saying? Well, since he can pay you back with a metaltalin item, so just leave the shor in your hands, And the guy, you know, the buyer can sell the shore on his own. So it's basically the same thing. So what do they say? Obviously, Rav is the obvious answer. And that's why some people have a bit of a different nusach and a bit of a different way of reading it, because it's a little strange. It's quite obvious. In other words, the case is relevant. Rav's psak is relevant in a case where the guy does have cash on hand. And then the point is, Rav is telling you he has to give the guy cash. But it, what would come from this is that even according to Rav, if the guy doesn't have cash, if the seller already spent the money that he received, then the guy would stick with his ox, and it would be, the, in essence, the same thing as Shmuel. So the case that Rav is saying differently than Shmuel would be a case where he has cash to pay him back. Now that we're going to explain the shitot a little bit better. Rav Amar, Hareze Mekach Ta'ut. Why do we claim it's a Mekach Ta'ut? Now here, I kind of explained the Shitot, but I didn't explain it based on this because I wanted to wait till we got here. Now we're going to see it more in depth, which is the real issue here is Batar Ruba Azlinan. We go by the Rov. Now what do most people buy a shore for? In those days, certainly. Beruba L'Rad Yazavne. Most people buy a shore to plow. Because most people needed shvarim for plowing in their fields. That was right. We have already learned the whole masechet about the fields and whose field is whose. When you sell, obviously people were plowing their fields all the time. So most people buy shor for plowing. And therefore, what does Rav say? It's a mekach ta'ut, because if you sell a shor for shechita, the owner, the buyer can say, hey, I didn't want a shor for shechita. I'm like the Rav. I go by the Rav, and the Rav say that, you know, most people buy for plowing, and based on the Rav, that's what allows Rav to say you can claim Mekach Ta'ut. Shmuel Amar Alecha. Now, what's Shmuel going to say against Rav's claim? Okay, that what? Ki Azlina Bataruva. There's a very important statement. Bi Isura, but Bimamona Lo. The whole concept of following the Rav is when it comes to Isur Veheter. Okay, it's something us or something mutar, all different cases where we'll see some cases soon. We go after the Rav. But in Mamon, we don't. Now, why don't we go by Rav in Mamon? This goes back to what I said from the beginning. Because there's another concept of Hamotzi Mechavero Alav Harayan. The Muchzak, you know, the status quo is always more pressing. You know, it's not that we don't ever follow Rav, but that there's something, there's other issues that are bigger. So in this case, we're going to say that that while we follow Rav when it comes to Isur V'Heter, when it comes to Mamonot, we're going to go by who's the Muchzak. Okay? And in this case, if you bought the animal, and the animal's in your possession already, then if you want to try to prove that you bought this animal for Harisha, you have to prove it. And until you can prove that, tough luck. You're stuck with it. Okay? That's how Rav holds. So now we're going to have a series of questions. We're only going to get started on them against one Shita or the other. Okay, of Rav and Shmuel. This is a very basic machloket. Meitibe. So our first source is from Ketubot. Okay? Ha'isha shenit armela, o shenit almena, o nitgarsha. Okay, she becomes widowed or divorced. Now what's the issue? She wants to get her ketubah money. What's the problem? Okay, in this case, she doesn't have a written ketubah, obviously, otherwise it would be easy. She doesn't have a written ketubah. And the question is, we learned that a bitula gets a ketubah of matayim, and someone who is already married gets a ketubah of meah. So the question is, what's her ketubah? So she gets either widowed, in which case the husband, yeah, the yitomim are supposed to pay her the ketubah money, or she gets divorced where the husband's supposed to. V'hi omeret betulani seti. She says, I was a betula when I was married. By the way, remember, we said that if you didn't write a ketubah, you still get your ketubah money. It's one of those conditions that even if it's tanai beitim, we called it. So now, behu omer, now obviously it's not necessarily who, right? It's either the husband in the case of divorce, obviously in the case of the children, right, the widow, the children are saying, well, maybe you were betula. In other words, go prove it, right? We don't know. Maybe you weren't a betula. Right? In other words, the kids say, because what do we always say? Ta'anina, we're to'en li yitomim, whatever the father could have been to'en. So if the father could have claimed you weren't a betula, okay, so behu omer, lo ki el almana nisatich. I married you while you were an almana. So, what do we do? Im yesh edim sheyatza bihinuma v'rosha parua k'tubata matayim. Okay, here we start to learn a little bit of history. What was generally nahug in those days for a betula? We're going to learn that betulot went to weddings in a different way than already married women did. okay, if they were almanot or grushot. So, if there's edim, okay, what do we do? We do this nowadays, by the way, when there's all sorts of cases in the Beit Din where we don't know exactly what happened in the first marriage. We start to look at pictures, try to figure out, you know, what evidence. We call in witnesses for people who were at the wedding at the time. You know, let's say we want to see whether kosher witnesses, maybe, you know, like in a Surevet Get case, we could try to say, oh, maybe we could do Havgat Kiddushin. Maybe the wedding was never good to begin with. So we try to gather information about the wedding. So that's what they do here, okay? Obviously, they didn't have pictures. So what do? They try to find witnesses who remember what happened at the wedding. If they remember that she went out b'chinuma, okay, we'll talk about this word in a minute, and her hair was, okay, either uncovered, okay, which meant that once you were married, right, women kept their hair covered, or it could just mean that there was a minhag that, you know, Betula wore their hair loose, you know, and Malmano maybe had it tied together. Like, parua, it's never clear whether it means loose or uncovered, okay? But if this was the way that women went out to their, okay, so hinuma could be translated as a number of things. Could be a veil, okay, that was the minhag, that Betula went out with a veil. There were some other interpretations I saw that that hinuma, I think based on the Yerushalmi, one second. Right. So in the Yerushalmi, they bring up a dispute between people in Babel who say that it derives from the term nimnuma, which means a veil. And but in Eretz Yisrael, they derive it from a different term, which is paryoma. Okay? Which, I don't know where you get that from, Hinuma and Paryoma, but anyway, they say that, and then it's a debate among the Mefarshim what exactly a Paryoma is. So the Aruch, by the way, if we've ever discussed him, he's the earliest Aramaic dictionary from the, I think, 11th century. Okay, very early, and he actually is a dictionary, and sometimes he's quoted on the side, like by the Masoret HaShas, they'll say Perish Ba'aruch, or some of the guys on the side will bring up his interpretation, as do some of the Rishonim. So the Aruch explains it's a thin, light coat that was worn by the bride, and others say it was this chair that they carried the bride in on. Okay, so whatever it was, whether it was a veil, a chair, a coat, some sort of thing that typified that this is how, right, that I remember when she came out in her beautiful whatever. And that would prove, that would be enough to say, she must have been a betula when she got married. So, what do you derive from here, though? Right? That if there's edim she'atza b'hinuma v'rosha perua, ketuba tama tayim. So what's the obvious then? Tama di'ika edim. Haleka edim lo. If there weren't edim, it sounds like we wouldn't assume she was a betula and she wouldn't be able to get her money. Now, what does this go against? Amai. Lema halacha har rov hanashim. V'rov nashim betulot nistot. Right? We know that the majority of women, it's their first marriage, right? Most women, it's their first marriage.
You could also say that you're looking for edim in either case, right? Either you have an aide who says that she did or she didn't. If they can't find edim at all, you can't disprove it, though.
You can't disprove what?
How she came.
Right, but that's what they're saying. If there's edim, that what the source here is saying is, if there's edim, then we can follow, and we can assume she was a betula. But if not,
or there could be edim that say she wasn't.
That's true, but that's not what the source is saying. The source tells us, I can't remember if it's a Mishnah or a Brayta there, I think it's a Mishnah maybe, but it tells us that if there's edim, right, then she gets matayim. What's the obvious inference from there? If there's no edim, it's true. If there's edim that say that she wasn't a betula, then obviously she only gets ma'am. But the point being here is, what if there's no edim? If there's no edim, right? If there's any edim, then what are we going to say? Now, this is basically classic, hamotzime chavero ala paraya, right? She has to prove that she's a betula. That matches Shmuel. That doesn't match Rav. Because what does Rav say? We follow the Rav, and most nashim are betulot when they get married. Okay? So, Amar Ravina, so how are we going to answer this? Mishum de'ika lemeim rov nashim betulot nisot, umi'ut almanot. Okay, so now, we can say like this, right? This is a fact. Most women are betulot, but the minority and the minority are almanot. V'kol aniseit betula yesh lakol. When someone marries a betula, it's a very public event, right? We all know this. Second marriages often are not public events, right? They're not big deal events, but first marriages are generally, it's interesting that things haven't changed in that way, okay, that they discuss this, that's the minhag. So if yesh lakol, right, now what's the case here? The woman comes and claims she's a betula. Now, nobody in the court knows of this marriage at all, right? Otherwise, they would say, oh yeah, everybody knows she got married and, you know, she was a betula, it was a big deal wedding, this wedding. So everyone would have remembered, but obviously no one remembered if they needed to look for aiding. So therefore, there must not be a kol. V'zohu il v'ein la kol, itra la ruba. Now we start to deal with, that's why this is very interesting. You know, we have all these concepts, rove, we've learned this before with chazaka, migo, right? And what if you have conflicting things here? So on the one hand, what will Rav say? And Shmuel is very obvious. He says, this works perfectly. She's got to prove she wants to get the money. But Rav says, no. It's true we have a rove, but we have something working against this rove. And what's working against it? That there's no call about this wedding. If she really was married, everyone would have known about it as a betula. Everyone would have known. The fact that nobody knows about this wedding must mean that there's a good possibility that it was a second marriage. Once that's the case, we're not going to let her get the 200 unless she can prove it. So that's how Rav will explain this source. So now they say, wait a minute. E kol hanisot betulot yesh lahem kol. If, wait a minute. This whole answer of Ravina is based on the fact that kol hanisot betulot yesh lahem kol. Well, if that's the case, ki e ka edim mayhave midelet la kol sa de shikraninhu. If we're assuming this is a case where there's no kol, and what did we just say, right? If ain't kol, then what are we going to assume? That weakens the rove. Why does it weaken the rove? Because if it ain't kol, we're going to assume that she was an almana when she got married, or a grusha, or, right? She wasn't a betula. So now, if we have on the one hand, there was no kol, and therefore we assume she's an almana. But then Adam come and said, no, she was a betula. Why weren't we assuming that those Edim are false witnesses? Because we have something working against the Edim. We have this lack of kol about her wedding. What's interesting is they turn this lack of kol into something so great that it could even override witnesses. Because you have to remember, and that's what I think is so fascinating about the Sugya, is all the dinim of Rove, Migo, even Edim, okay, now Edim you would think is at the top, right? We said Edim, right, always overrides a chazaka, or, right, Edim always wins out. But even Edim is susceptible to people lying, right? And none of these are absolute. They're all ways that the rabbis tried to get closer to the truth. But they couldn't ever reach the truth 100% and know that they were getting the truth. So even witnesses, we still don't really know whether they're telling the truth. And even, right, when witnesses become Edim Zomimim, we're still not sure that the ones who said that they're lying were telling the truth or not, right? We don't really know. In fact, it's a whole interesting sugya that we'll get to with Sanhedrin, whether Edim Zomimim is because we're assuming they're telling the truth, or is it just a chidush, a chidsha Torah, that this is the way we can determine if there's Edut Sheker or not. But really, we don't know. Nobody really knows the truth. So therefore, they're putting up here, just because there's Edim, if there's something working against the Edim, maybe that should knock out the Edut. Because if there was no kol, then there's a much more of an assumption that she was married as a non-betula. So that's what the Gemara is asking, which I think is a really interesting question, because we always think Edim, al-pishnayim Edim yakum davar, but even Edut is not the strongest thing, because we couldn't be concerned that maybe they're lying. So, what are the answer? The answer, like we would have assumed, which is, Ela rov hanisot betulot yesh lahem kol, v'zohu il v'en lakol itra laruba. It just weakens the rov, but it doesn't weaken the edut, right? The assumption is that most women are betulot, and as most of the women who are betulot, it has a kol, but there are some people who make small weddings and people don't really know about them, and it doesn't mean just because nobody heard about your wedding that you weren't married as a betula, right? That's, they're saying it just, when we're measuring all the things, right? Edim, so now we put it on our list, right? Edim is stronger than the lack of kol, but rov is not stronger than the, right? In other words, the lack of kol weakens the rov, and therefore it doesn't allow us to follow the rov in this case. And that's, again, that's all just explaining rov, how rov would read this, because Shmuel obviously doesn't need any of this, because he just holds hamotzim chaver alav haraya. Because remember, he holds, rov doesn't even work in dinei mamonot, so it's not even relevant. Okay, next source, Tashma. Hamochir eved l'chaverov v'nimtza ganav o kubiostus. Okay, let's say you sell an eved to your friend, and it turns out the eved is a robber, or a kubiostus is a kidnapper. Okay? Higi'o. Okay? What does that mean, higi'o? Listen, you bought the eved, you're stuck with it. Okay? Higi'a elav, basically. In other words, you bought it, it's now in your possession, there's nothing you could do about it. Listi mizuyan, o muhtav lemachut. If he's a listi mizuyan, which means basically that he mugs people at gunpoint, which means what? Eventually he'll be brought to din and he'll be killed. Okay? In other words, you'll end up without an eved at all. Or he's muhtav lemachut, which means there's a warrant out for his arrest to kill him, basically. So, omer lo, haresha chalafanecha. So you can go back to the seller and say, hey, give me my eved back. So again, they're going to question this according to Rav and say, Resha mai, taima, lav mishum deruba, hachi itnehu. Sorry, this is a support of Rav, right? Aren't we assuming.
You money back?
If you're listing mizuyan, you should get your money back. But what about this nimtsa ganavu kubiostus? My taima, lav mishum deruba, hachi itnehu. Is it not because rov are. Ganavim, okay, here's another assumption about these avadim, that most of them steal, okay, that's just the nature of an eved, that he's going to steal your stuff, and he's going to, now, it's maybe a little easier to say about stealing things. Kubiostus, that he kidnaps people, is a little more harsh to say, oh, the standard is that this is the case, but...
They give an alternative translation, gambler?
Oh, a gambler? That's interesting. Okay. A gambler makes better sense, right? The Rashbam says he's a gonev nefashot. Now I'm saying someone else must say that. I don't know who says it. Anyway, right. So maybe that's a better, that he's a gambler. So now, what are we going to say? Is it not because most of them are like that? And that's why when you bought the Eved, you knew that that's what you were getting. And that's why you can't say, oh, I didn't know he was a ganav. Come on, Rov or Ganavim, you should know that. In which case, this is a support for Rav saying, we follow Rov and Dine Mamono. So now the Gemara is going to say, lo, you can't necessarily say that. Why? Why does this work? Not because of Rov, but because Kulu Hachiinuhu. Every single Eved is a Ganav or a Kubiostus. Okay? And that's a very extreme statement about these Ganavim. But it's basically saying this has nothing to do with Dine Rov at all. As they thought that the source had to do with Dine Rov and was supporting Rav, which is that we do follow Rov and Dine Mamonot. In the end, they say, no, this has absolutely nothing to do with Rov. This is all Avadim or Ganavim, or Kubiostusim, which means that's why if you buy them, you're stuck with it, because you knew that getting in, they're all like that. Okay? It's a bit of an extreme statement against Avadim, you know, saying that they're all, it's one of those. You know, again, the assumptions you're talking about in Eved Kanani, and again, it's these assumptions about the people living in those times, right, that they were all, you know, ganavim. Of course, we have it nowadays. I was going to say, right, I didn't want to say this because I'm a little hesitant to also, you know, badmouth, because obviously there's housekeepers who are very, very honest, but we also know that there's a lot of housekeepers, you're put in a situation where it's very easy to steal a few things. And therefore, yeah, that's why I said, I think distinguish, especially according to the Rashbam, who says this, gonev nefashot, I think there's a big difference between stealing a few items from somebody's house and you know, stealing, kidnapping is a bit more extreme. Also, I think the stealing in the house is a much more obvious, it's so in their face, you know, so easy to do, and it's just, you know, they can just take little things here and there. Kind of obvious. I once had a situation where someone was stealing from me, and I went back to the person who had referred the person to me, and the person said, oh yeah, everybody knows she steals, you know, but which I was a little bit shocked by, but you know, I fired her at that point, but he kept her, you know, like that was his attitude. I said, oh, okay. So yeah, that, which was interesting. He had that exact attitude. We all know that. We know that going in, that's sort of just what it is and accept it. And, you know, you certainly can't claim mekach ta'ub based on that. So anyway, I should show him this source. Support his...
opposite. Oh, she stole it. Not that I lost my...
Right. That's the other problem. We all accuse them of having stolen things, but really we lose our items. That's also the classic, you know. It's easy to say, oh, you know, they probably got stolen, when really it was, you know, we lost it. Okay, so we're going to continue more with these dinim tomorrow.